We're discussing an investigation of nursing home violations on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The Milwaukee Journal Sentinel did this detailed review of nursing home safety with a data set covering 10 months, March 2020 through this January. And it's shining a light on instances of lax staff testing in some homes, stockpiled PPE under lock and key, and families out of the loop when a loved one fell ill with COVID. Are you or a family member in a nursing home? What safety precautions has the facility taken? What are your experiences like? 800-642-1234. Daphne Chen is a data and investigations reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Daphne, welcome to the Ideas Network. Hi, Daphne. Can you hear us?
Yes, I'm here. How are you?
Hi, good. Thanks for being here. We also have your colleague, Sarah Vulpenhain, who is a Report for America reporter focusing on news of value to underserved communities for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Sarah, welcome back.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Well, Sarah, let's start with you. Your investigation found that 133 nursing homes across Wisconsin had COVID-related violations. Give us a sense of what these citations were calling out.
Yeah, so there were a variety of different kinds of violations. There were some more serious ones that we found where COVID positive staff, for instance, were being asked to come back to work. Some nursing homes weren't screening visitors or staff for symptoms, and some weren't isolating infected or potentially infected residents. But the most common violation that we found were staff not using masks, gowns, other kinds of personal protective equipment properly. So on the more serious end, we found a nursing home that was using flannel shirts in place of gowns, even though they had an ample supply of gowns. Some staff members weren't wearing masks in the building. Some were just wearing surgical masks into rooms of isolated or quarantined residents when they're supposed to be in full PPE, which is, you know, mask, gown, gloves, and eye protection. And not using PPE could range from a variety of things on the more serious end to, you know, not changing PPE between units or rooms, not putting on or taking off your PPE properly. It could mean that you were missing a piece of PPE when you were going into a quarantined or an isolated residence room, like maybe you weren't wearing eye protection. But then we also found other violations like, you know, nursing homes not testing their residents or their staff as frequently as they should. Mm-hmm. A lot of nursing homes during the fall were required to test twice a week their staff members. Some of them that we found weren't testing them at all when they were supposed to be doing that. And then we also found some of them were very lax about screening their staff for symptoms or lax about screening visitors for symptoms. And some weren't quarantining or isolating residents when they should, for example, when they're newly admitted to the nursing home after a hospital visit or when they start showing symptoms of COVID-19.
So certainly a wide range of instances where public health, the best public health practices not being followed. Daphne, you were deep into this data. What did you notice with these citation trends among nursing homes? I mean, did you find any types of trends in terms of like rural parts of the state versus urban?
No, we really saw issues and struggles across the state. Some of these homes were, you know, way up in the Northwoods and in really rural parts of the city. In really rural parts of the state, and some were, you know, in the middle of the city or in the suburbs. And I think it just speaks to how prevalent the pandemic was and how much it spread around the state. And also, you know, we looked at Wisconsin, but we also took a look at Chicago and Cook County just to compare. Mm-hmm. And the numbers were very, very similar. So we feel like, you know, this was an issue that was pretty universal.
Any differences between the size of nursing homes, a large home versus a small nursing home, or anything like that?
So we didn't look at that issue specifically, but okay. There has been research done, you know, this year by other researchers. And what they found is, you know, looking at alternative nursing homes that are smaller, that have fewer staff circulating in and out, that focus on having residents with their own private rooms and private bathrooms, tended to fare better during the pandemic. They had lower coronavirus infection rates and death rates.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with journalists Daphne Chen there and Sarah Volpenhayn. They're of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. They're sharing their comprehensive investigation of nursing home safety. It came out recently, and it's looking at what's happening inside nursing homes amid the pandemic. You can share your experiences. Do you have a family member in a nursing home? What safety precautions has the facility taken? Do you feel staff are following public health protocols, or maybe not enough? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Daphne, take us to Toma Nursing and Rehab Center. In December, it revealed two residents who had tested positive for COVID. How did the facility respond in these situations?
Right. So Toma was cited on a couple different occasions. You know, initially we had asked Toma about a PPE related citation, you know, nursing home officials who had locked equipment up in a storage area and employees reporting that they couldn't get to it. And so they had to use garbage bags sometimes, gowns, you know, they needed to take care of their residents and they couldn't wait for the proper PPE. You know, officials there just said, you know, we spare no expense in obtaining that PPE and we haven't been perfect, but we worked extremely hard. But, you know, they were later cited for a couple more violations. A resident with low oxygen levels who wasn't sent to the hospital for, you know, 8 hours, despite, you know, the nurse practitioner saying that this person needed to be sent immediately, ended up passing away. Another COVID positive resident who became dehydrated and developed a severe infection in her mouth and also died was part of the report. And so, and they didn't want to respond to the subsequent violations. And so this is kind of an example of the struggles that were going on behind the scenes at a lot of nursing homes, you know, visitors not allowed for a large part of the year. And so these inspection reports are kind of a rare glimpse into the operations during the pandemic.
Sarah, were these violations happening when inspectors were on site at nursing homes, or were they reports of other times? How did that work?
Yeah, a lot of them were happening when inspectors were on site, though some of the ones, like with the residents who died, like at Toma, inspectors weren't necessarily on scene when that was happening, but the death may have triggered the inspection and a look into what happened for that to occur. But a lot of these violations were observed directly by inspectors, particularly the PPE violations. During the pandemic, a lot of inspectors shifted their focus to infection control violations, and yeah. So were going to the nursing home specifically to observe the staff and the facility for how they were complying with the PPE protocols and with new coronavirus safety related protocols. So yes, a lot of these they did observe themselves.
We're talking with Milwaukee Journal Sentinel journalists Sarah Volpenhayn and Daphne Chen about their investigative reporting on Wisconsin nursing homes breaking COVID safety protocols. Are you a staff at a nursing home? Which part of the state do you work? How is morale? What is your stress level on the job? How are residents doing? Are they fully vaccinated? 800-642-1234. Back in a minute on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. We're breaking down the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel's recent investigative report. It found 1 in 3 Wisconsin nursing homes violated COVID safety protocols between March 2020 and January of this year. According to the latest federal data, more than 131,000 nursing home residents have died with COVID nationwide. Over 500,000 staff have contracted the virus. And the reporters behind the nursing home safety investigation, Daphne Chen and Sarah Volpenhayn, they stay with us for 10 more minutes. Let's bring in Jim now in River Falls. Hi, Jim.
Hi, thanks for the program. I just wanted to point out that the Trump administration, HHS, they changed the rules regarding how nursing homes were fined for violations of protocol or whatever, so that they would be fined once for a violation. And prior to that, if the homes would stay in violation of a protocol, they would be fined every day they were in violation. So that really decreased the motivation for these nursing homes to correct their problems.
Jim, thank you. Sarah, what did you see from federal regulators?
So federal regulators don't have a lot of avenues for penalizing, you could say, the nursing homes. A lot of times when a violation is found, the nursing home is then given the opportunity to correct that violation. And so they will put in place some measures to try to correct it or reverse what they were doing incorrectly. And then normally they're not fined anything. I believe that some of the nursing homes were fined in these cases, but it's normally a very small percentage of them that are fined, or they're not fined very much. It's usually between several hundred and, maybe $10,000 or $15,000 that they're fined. So there's not, you hear from advocates a lot that there's not a lot of enforcement of some of these violations. And, they say that they aren't penalized much for a lot of what inspectors find.
Let's bring in Carol now in Milwaukee. Carol, hi.
Hi. I understand from an article I read that nursing homes in general make a much higher profit. Like a regular hospital makes lucky if they make 2% profit, whereas a nursing home, many, not all, a large number of them make about a 7% profit. And the reason is, and they're saying that they don't have enough hired help because they can't afford it. They're so poor. Well, the reason they're so poor, this group of nursing homes, a large group, is because they pay very high rent, but they're actually paying it to themselves because through LLCs, they own the property that they are renting from indirectly, and they're actually profiting from their own rent.
Yeah, Carol, getting into the balance sheets there, but also probing a little bit on the staffing shortage in these nursing homes and their bottom lines. And, Daphne, there's been a well-documented staffing shortage in nursing homes for years, made worse by low wages. How does that translate into care for some residents when you looked at this data?
Yeah, staffing shortages was a huge problem even before the pandemic. And so it only got worse during the pandemic as staff got sick, burnt out, had people in the family get sick and couldn't work. So we, found that was mentioned as an underlying issue for citations in about 1 in 10 cases. And there were some really bad examples that we found in the violations. When it comes to finances, that is sort of one of the big sticking points, is that nursing homes and administrators, organizations say, the reimbursements, the Medicaid reimbursements we get to pay for care, they just don't cover the cost of care. And so we're forced to short staff. But the financial structures, as this caller has pointed out, the financial structures and profits of these nursing homes can be very complicated.
Mm-hmm.
I think about 70 to 80% of them are for profit. And so there's just not a lot of visibility into how the money is shaking out and whether, there could be more money put into staffing or other preventative measures. And so that's been a real debate between advocates and nursing home representatives, is how do we know that the money is going where it needs to go and not to profits for executives.
Let's bring in Mary now in Madison, who was in a nursing home. Mary, hi. What is your experience?
Hi. Well, I would like to know how to contact legally, about the nursing home. Well, I remember when I fell down, later on in the evening, and I got out of the bed, and then I decided to go back in, but I couldn't reach the button, and so I fell and hit my head, and I was yelling for help for about half an hour. And so later on, and the office is at the other end, and I was, they found me laying on, because they, they take checks on the room.
Yeah, they check on the rooms. You had fallen. Yes. You tried to get help, reach for your call button. You waited a half hour. Sarah, how do residents file complaints? How do they, how can residents speak up?
Yeah, so not knowing specifically in Mary's case, but there are a number of ways that residents sometimes have to speak up. At some nursing homes are resident councils where they can meet and bring some of their concerns to administrators. The problem with that was during the pandemic, a lot of that was shut down because of coronavirus restrictions. But there's also the ombudsman program with the state where family members can report concerns or complaints, and the ombudsman can follow up on that. There's also ways to get in touch with the State Health Department's Division of Quality Assurance, which is the division that does these inspections and has the oversight role over the nursing homes. In conjunction with the federal government, and they can look into some complaints. Actually, complaints are what triggers mm-hmm. some of these inspections that occur.
As we talk here about nursing homes with Sarah Volpenhayn and Daphne Chen of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, Daphne, you talked with different experts about solutions to help struggling nursing homes. What did you find out?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so this also there's a variety of different opinions out there, and this sort of touches on the debate over whether nursing homes have been equipped enough to handle these kinds of things. So there's a group of people and experts who think, the tougher regulations, tougher fines, that's not going to help, and we need to invest more money into long-term care. We need to invest resources into strike teams and education to help these nursing homes fix issues as they come up. And there's other advocates who have looked at the homes that did well during the pandemic, smaller nursing homes that gave people private rooms, private bathrooms, nursing homes that were really, really strict with doing temperature and oxygen checks throughout the day, you know, locking down early. And so I think that the pandemic has pushed people in the long-term care industry to think, what can we re-envision entirely? How do we really want to treat older people or people who are more frail in our society? And how much money is it going to really take to ensure that they are safe? But I think that the trend is going to be looking towards smaller nursing homes with more staff and higher funding.
Well, thank you both for joining us.
Thank you so much.
That was the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel's Daphne Chen, who is a data and investigations reporter. Sarah Volpenhayn is a Report for America reporter covering underserved communities. We have a link to their reporting at WPR.org/mornings. Ahead this hour, it is Wisconsin Life, and then we continue our Friday series on this year's Best Picture nominees for the Academy Awards. News update is next. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Ahead this hour, we look at two of this year's Best Picture nominees for the Academy Awards. Have you seen Minari? Have you seen Sound of Metal? What do you think of these films? 800-642-1234. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's host Maureen McCollum sharing a story about the time Wisconsin hosted a mini Woodstock.
Wisconsin Life is celebrating its 10th anniversary on WPR this year. One way we're commemorating this milestone is by asking producers to share their favorite stories. I reached out to Kirill Owen, a former technical director at WPR, about what her favorite story was. And this was the first piece that came to her mind. 51 years ago this month, long-haired hippies and flower children from across the Midwest converged on a small Wisconsin farm for a weekend of peace, love, and music. The Soundstorm Music Festival's lineup was stacked with mostly regional artists, but also included the Grateful Dead, who played a five-hour set. Historian Michael Edmonds tells the story.
It was April 1970 in Poinette, Wisconsin, of all places, just a few months after Woodstock. People wondered whether Woodstock could be replicated other places. So there was a little momentum to see what could be done. There was a local promoter of youth events who had the initial idea, but that was before Pete Bobo showed up. Pete was a biker who had been living on the West Coast. He met the Grateful Dead in San Francisco and stayed for a while on Ken Kesey's farm. And he lived to make a little money, ride his bike, have a good time. And he envisioned doing that for tens of thousands of people at once. Dead Dead were not famous. They were still relatively young. They were in their late 20s or around 30 years old. And they were still San Francisco's favorite house band. They were not a national sensation yet. Local officials in Poinette did everything in their power to stop it. You had a wonderful, almost idyllic, law-abiding small town. Several hundred people, where literally the churches outnumbered the taverns, and they were terrified of being outnumbered 20-1 by beatniks and hippies and bikers. And as one of the selectmen said, we didn't know, but they'd smash the windows and burn the whole town down. Hey, Saturday night. Yeah. That gig garnered some press, and a grandmother up in Poinette, who had a big sprawling farm and didn't get along real well with her neighbors, said, why don't you come up here and see if you can have it up here? That farm, the farm of Irene York, turned out to be a perfect place for a festival, and she agreed to let them lease it for $5,000. As her son said in an interview, Mother didn't care what the people of Poinette thought, and she told them so. Sugar, make no
blossoms blooming. It's all empty. I don't care.
Tens of thousands of people streamed in and out of the York Farm over the course of that weekend. The weather was gorgeous, around 80 and sunny. There was a little creek behind the stage, and people swam naked in the creek, played in the mud. There was always the fragrance of marijuana smoke in the air the whole weekend. There were no fights. There were no injuries. Almost everyone I spoke to who went said that they remembered it vividly, and it changed their lives somehow. It proved to them that it was possible for 30,000 strangers to get along peacefully, ecstatically even, for several days and have 3 days of peace, love, and music.
That was historian Michael Edmonds talking about Soundstorm Music Festival, which took place in April 1970 in Poinette, Wisconsin. Former WPR technical director Kirill Owen mixed that story and wanted to share it as part of Wisconsin Life's 10th anniversary. She says she loves the fact that the Dead's obsessive documentarians have yet to find the audio from this show. Kirill hopes that someone finds a reel-to-reel in a box someday. She also just loves the story and Grandma York and has been a Dead fan since high school when she first saw them in February 1971. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
And now for some Oscar buzz. On Fridays in April, we make space to talk about this year's Best Picture nominees leading up to the Academy Awards on Sunday the 25th. So next up, it's Minari. Have you seen the semi-autobiographical film on writer and director Lee Isaac Chung's life in a family of Korean immigrants in Arkansas in the 80s? Bring your Oscar predictions, your must-love films, 800-642-1234. Anna Thompson-Hodgick is here, senior lecturer at UW-Whitewater, teaches courses on film. Hi, Anna. Welcome back.
Hi. Lovely morning to talk about this film. Yes.
Yeah, hi. Set us up with a sketch of what Minari is about.
So yeah, Minari is about a family, a young immigrant family from Korea, and particularly the father slash husband's dream to have his own farm, and they move to rural Arkansas, and some of the backstory is this family has lived in California for some period of time, doing so many of the types of jobs that immigrants do, and they're in this case, they both have worked. The young couple has worked as sexing chickens in a chicken plant in California, and these are the kinds of jobs that nobody really wants to do, right? They're hard jobs, and this young man has this dream to again have his own farm, raise his own produce. And that's when we meet this young family. They are driving to their property for the first time, and it's not at all what the wife expects. And so there, it's kind of some struggles along the way, and it ends up being just a beautifully shot film. It's about this family and their adjustment and ultimately their pursuit of the American dream.
Minari is the Korean word for an edible plant in East Asia. And the film, it really ties food very closely to identity. How do you see those interconnections there?
So I think we really see this play out, particularly through the character of the grandmother. And the grandmother coming from Korea to live with this family. And, she's kind of this kind of fun character, actually. She embraces life. She has a particular bond she develops with the young grandson in the family. And she, it's her idea, in fact, to plant this edible Asian plant on the property. And it becomes a kind of metaphor for, I think, both the old world and the new, and embracing change in so many ways, but also, allowing this family to have a connection to the old way of life. And then the young grandson, who was born in the United States, I think it also sort of symbolizes the bond here between the grandmother and the grandson.
Oh, and he is going to steal our heart, that little guy.
Yeah, very cute little boy.
So adorable. Yeah. Mm-hmm, and mm-hmm. Much of the dialogue is in Korean. What are your thoughts around representation around, Asian American identities in this film?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so this is it's got an interesting pedigree. Lee Isaac Chung, as you mentioned, the director, was born in the United States, and the film is produced by, has a thoroughly American pedigree. Brad Pitt's production company actually produced the film, but it is shot all in pretty much all in Korean. There's some, English dialogue as well, and I think it brings an interesting perspective to, again, that immigrant experience. I was doing some background research on the film, and I know that I had read that Chung had originally wanted to adapt My Aunt Nia.
Oh.
and then couldn't, Willa Cather always never liked her books to be adapted into films, and so Chung kind of was taken aback by this, but he thought, well, I have my own immigrant story here to tell. And so it's so fascinating because there are so many parallels really to the story of My Aunt Nia, from 150 years earlier. And it is a kind of universal immigrant story in so many respects. So that is something that I think really, makes the film, just like when we talked about last week to Nomadland, a film very much of the cultural moment right now that we're in, and particularly so because of Asian Americans right now too. All of what Asian Americans, the headlines right now with Asian Americans sort of under attack in recent weeks and recent months, and really the past year. And so I think that also makes the film particularly timely right now as well.
In those Oscar categories, Minari received a nomination for original music score. And let's just take a moment to listen to some music by composer Emil Mosseri. Anna, how did the music play a role in your experience watching this film?
The musical score is lovely, and it so much of the film takes place on the land that this family owns, and so the music really complements our experience of exploring this landscape, rural Arkansas, but it really does have a kind of beauty to the cinematography, and the music just very much complements the cinematography and the landscape. So yes, it's a lovely, really kind of an intimate portrayal of this family and their American dream for sure.
Let's continue listening to music from the Oscar-nominated film Minari. Anna Thompson-Hodgick, she's here, senior lecturer at UW-Whitewater, teaching courses on film. Which performances did you enjoy watching in Minari or Sound of Metal? Who deserves an Oscar this year? Still time to talk, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute on the Ideas Network. Listening to an original song from the movie Sound of Metal. The song is Green by Abraham Martyr. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kant. These Fridays in April, we're setting aside time to talk about this year's nominees for Best Picture ahead of the Academy Awards. If you've seen Sound of Metal, about a musician who loses his hearing, would you recommend it? It's nominated for 6 Oscars. Join in 800-642-1234. Anna Thompson-Hodgick is a senior lecturer at UW-Whitewater, and she's our guide. So, Anna, let's start off with just a bit of the trailer here for Sound of Metal.
Your hearing is deteriorating rapidly.
We'll come back. Till then, Lou, we just keep going, okay?
No.
Lou, no. Let's play them all. Let's see what it's like, okay? I'm going to be like a click track. You can play to me.
All right, so take us into this movie. What is Sound of Metal?
So Sound of Metal is the story of a drummer, kind of a heavy metal band, and he loses his hearing literally overnight. And this trauma of this sudden loss is really, you know, kind of where we're at the very beginning of the film. And then, you know, the film is follows his journey ultimately to accepting that hearing loss. And eventually, too, he, you know, comes to embrace the deaf community. But, you know, it really is, you know, following this character portrayed by Riz Ahmed in just an incredible performance. And, he comes to, you know, live in this this kind of home for not only individuals that are deaf, but also individuals that were former addicts. And so you have, you know, kind of the hearing loss and overlaid on there kind of the history of drug use. But it is it's a really great film, and kind of underscored by these themes of resilience ultimately. And, you know, kind of how this deaf, him becoming deaf, how it impacts other relationships in his life. And again, just a really incredible performance by Riz Ahmed. And then supported as well by the character actor, Paul Racy, who plays a kind of mentor to this drummer and helps him to, again, accept this loss, helps him to, you know, find support and community in this story. So it's a lovely story. I found this film to be incredibly moving, but also uplifting too. I mean, all of the films, you know, I think from this cycle of the Oscar nominees are uplifting in their own way, but I found this film to be particularly so.
Interesting, the film cast actors from the deaf community. How do you think that informed the authenticity of this film?
Well, yes, I think that is a really interesting casting choice. Again, another parallel from last week's Nomadland, where Chloe Zhao used so many, you know, people that weren't professional actors. This time around, you do have people that are, from the deaf community, providing that level of authenticity. Now, it's interesting, Riz Ahmed is not deaf, and so there were some folks who said that, well, that's not right. You should have cast an actual deaf actor in this role. But it's interesting. Darius Marder, the director, has said that he really wanted to have an actor that was not deaf and had to kind of learn how to be deaf. Ah. And that is so critical, I think, in this story, because we first meet this character when he is, you know, a hearing person. And we are taken through this journey with him. And we also it is a really traumatic experience, right? One moment you're fine, you can hear. And again, it literally happens to him overnight, where he has lost his hearing. Yeah. And Martyr was, sorry, go ahead.
Oh, I was gonna say, Paul Racy, who plays the leader of a recovery group for the deaf and received a supporting actor nomination. And, you know, he said that he grew up in the Chicago Club of the Deaf, and that he said the Santa Claus he knew was a deaf Santa. So he has a lot of connections to this particular, to this particular disability.
Right. Racy is, again, interesting because he was raised by deaf parents, and he's just been this kind of character actor his whole life, and does all these other things. He works as a deaf interpreter, and he kind of takes acting roles here and there, and then a deaf interpreter. And then it's interesting, he's also, in his real life, a lead singer for a Black Sabbath tribute band. So that was kind of interesting to hear. But, you know, he's over, you know, 73 years old, and this, you know, his first Oscar nomination, right? And it's so, so fascinating. And I think, too, this is a film, both Raisi and Riz Ahmed, this is their first Oscar nominations. You know, the same would go for the Minari. We have, Yoon Young-jun with her first Oscar nomination at the age of 73. And so it's just, it's really interesting, this crop of films this year. We have so many sort of first time nominees that's something that really also, you know, is very much the truth here with Sound of Metal. It's interesting.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about the film Sound of Metal with Anna Thompson-Hodgick. She teaches film at UW-Whitewater. You can join in. Have you seen it? Have you seen Minari? Do you think they deserve to be in the Best Picture category? What do you love or what did you dislike about these films? 800-642-1234. Sound of Metal also received nominations in film editing and original screenplay, but it also sound, right? I mean, sound is what this music is about. How does sound design give it a really powerful effect? What does it do?
I think it really sets this film apart, and you know, it gives you the sensation as the viewer of this film to try to, you know, have some understanding of what our lead character is going through. And it does this very effectively through, again, the sound design, the sound editing. You know, when he, for the first time is experiencing deafness, you hear a kind of ringing on the soundtrack, and then it all goes quiet except for just some little muffling noises. And this comes back later on in the film when our lead character, he decides to get these implants, which are quite controversial in the deaf community. And you hear when he gets these implants put in, you hear what he hears, and you hear sort of the distortion that can take place for folks that do decide to get implants. And it's just really
A highly sensory experience for that viewer.
Right. And again, that's something that I think is particularly just something that's never really been done before in terms of the history of American film. And, you know, we've had plenty of movies that have put deaf protagonists at the forefront, you know, famously, Children of a Lesser God.
I was just about to say that one. Yeah, one of my favorites.
Yeah, yeah, and that was, I think, 1985 or so. And that actress, Marlee Matlin, she won Best Actress for her performance in that role, and it was very notable because it was, you know, she was actually deaf. You know, you had other films where you had, you know, hearing actors and actresses play those kinds of roles. But this film is just very different in that it follows the protagonist who's hearing at the beginning and then, you know, goes through that process of losing their hearing. So
Anna, thank you for joining us.
Mm-hmm. Yes. No, it was fun as usual. So I look forward to next week.
Me too. Anna Thompson-Hodgick, senior lecturer at UW-Whitewater, teaches courses on film. Come back next week for more Oscar Buzz. Every Friday in April, Anna drops by to discuss two of the Best Picture nominees. So next up is The Father and Judas and the Black Messiah. Check out these films. Join the conversation next Friday. Just ahead, we have an hour-long conversation about cryptocurrency. Are you a Bitcoin user? Are you interested in starting? What questions do you have about digital currencies? 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.